odor of dry waller's mud, with an underlying scent of wood stain. Standing in the breakfast area, Teal listened for more sounds of destruction. Movement. Nothing. If this was like most California tract homes, he would find the dining room to the left beyond the kitchen, then the living room, the entrance foyer, and a den. If he went into the hallway that led out of the breakfast area, he would probably find a laundry room, the downstairs bath, a coat closet, then the foyer. He could see no advantage of one route over another, so he went into the hall and checked the laundry first. The dark room had no windows. The door was standing half open, and the flashlight showed only yellow cabinets and the spaces where the washer and dryer would be placed. However, Teal wanted to look at the section behind the door, where he figured there was a sink and work area. He pushed the door all the way open and went in fast, swinging the flashlight and the gun in that direction. He found the stainless steel sink and built-in table that he expected, but no killer. He was more on edge than he had been in years. He could not keep the image of the dead man from flickering repeatedly through his mind. Those empty eye sockets. Not just on edge, he thought. Face it, you're scared shitless. Out front, Ken jumped across a narrow ditch and headed for the house's double entrance doors, which were still closed. He surveyed the surrounding area and saw no one trying to escape. As twilight descended, Bordeaux Ridge looked less like a tract under development than like a bombed-out neighborhood. Shadows and dust created the illusion of rubble. In the laundry room, Teal Porter turned, intending to step into the hall, and on his right, in the group of yellow cabinets, the 2-foot-wide, 6-foot-high door of a broom closet flew open, and this thing came at him, as if it were a jack-in-the-box. Jesus! For a split second he was sure it must be a kid in a rubber fright mask. He could not see clearly in the backsplash of the flashlight, which was pointed away from the attacker. But then he knew it was real, because those eyes, like circles of smoky lamplight, were not just plastic or glass. No way. He fired the revolver, but it was aimed ahead into the hall, and the slug plowed harmlessly into the wall out there. So he tried to turn, but the thing was all over him, hissing like a snake. He fired again, into the floor this time. The sound was deafening in that enclosed space. Then he was driven backward against the sink, and the gun was torn out of his hand. He also lost the flashlight, which spun off into the corner. He threw a punch, but before his fist was halfway through its arc, he felt a terrible pain in his belly, as if several stilettos had been thrust into him all at once, and he knew instantly what was happening to him. He screamed, screamed, and in the gloom, the misshapen face of the jack-in-the-box loomed over him, its eyes radiantly yellow, and Teal screamed again, flailed, and more stilettos sank through the soft tissue of his throat. Ken Dimes was 4 steps from the front doors when he heard Teal scream. A cry of surprise, fear, pain. Shit! There were double doors, stained oak. The one on the right was secured to the sill and header by sliding bolts, while the one on the left was the active door, and unlocked. Ken rushed inside, caution briefly forgotten, then halted in the gloomy foyer. Already the screaming had stopped. He switched on his flashlight. Empty living room to the right. Empty den to the left. A staircase leading up to the second floor. No one anywhere in sight. Silence. Perfect silence. As in a vacuum. For a moment, Ken hesitated to call out to Teal, for fear he would be revealing his position to the killer. Then he realized that the flashlight, without which he could not proceed, was enough to give him away. It did not matter if he made noise. Teal! The name echoed through the vacant rooms. Teal, where are you? No reply. Teal must be dead. Jesus. He would respond if he was alive. Or he might just be injured and unconscious, wounded and dying. In that case, perhaps it would be best to go back to the patrol car and call for an ambulance. No. No. If his partner was in desperate shape, Ken had to find him fast and administer first aid. Teal might die in the time it took to call an ambulance. Delay that long was too great a risk. Besides, the killer had to be dealt with. Only the vaguest smoky red light penetrated the windows now, for the day was being swallowed by the night. Ken had to rely entirely on the flashlight, which was not ideal, because each time the beam moved, shadows leaped and swooped, creating illusory assailants. Those false attackers might distract him from real danger. Leaving the front door wide open, he crept along the narrow hall that led to the back of the house. He stayed close to the wall. The sole of one of his shoes squeaked with nearly every step he took. He held the gun out in front of him, not aimed at the floor or ceiling, because for the moment, at least, he didn't give a damn about safe weapons procedure. On the right, a door stood open. A closet. Empty. The stink of his own perspiration grew greater than the lime and woodstain odors of the house. He came to a powder room on his left. A quick sweep of the light revealed nothing out of the ordinary, though his own frightened face, reflected in the mirror, startled him. The rear of the house, family room, breakfast area, kitchen, was directly ahead, and on his left was another door standing open. In the beam of the flashlight, which suddenly began to quiver violently in his hand, Ken saw Teal's body on the floor of a laundry room, and so much blood that there could be no doubt he was dead. Beneath the waves of fear that washed across the surface of his mind, there were undercurrents of grief, rage, hatred, and a fierce desire for vengeance. Behind Ken, something thumped. He cried out and turned to face the threat. But the hall to the right and the breakfast area to the left were both deserted. The sound had come from the front of the house. Even as the echo of it died away, he knew what he'd heard. The front door being closed. Another sound broke the stillness, not as loud as the first, but more unnerving, the clack of the door's deadbolt being engaged. Had the killer departed and locked the door from the outside with a key? But where would he get a key? Off the foreman that he had murdered? And why would he pause to lock up? More likely, he had locked the door from inside, not merely to delay Ken's escape, but to let him know the hunt was still underway. Ken considered dousing the flashlight, because it pinpointed him for the enemy, but by now the twilight glow at the windows was purple-gray and did not reach into the house at all. Without the flashlight, he would be blind. How the hell was the killer finding his way in this steadily deepening darkness? Was it possible that a PCP junkie's night vision improved when he was high, just as his strengths increased to that of 10 men as a side effect of the angel dust? The house was quiet. He stood with his back to the hallway wall. He could smell Teal's blood, a vaguely metallic odor. Click, click, click. Ken stiffened and listened intently, but he heard nothing more after those 3 quick noises. They had sounded like swift footsteps crossing the concrete floor, taken by someone wearing boots with hard leather heels or shoes with cleats. The noises had begun and ended so abruptly that he had not been able to tell where they were coming from. Then he heard them again. Click, 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 click. 4 steps this time. And they were in the foyer, moving in this direction toward the hall in which he stood. He immediately pushed away from the wall, turning to face the adversary, dropping into a crouch and thrusting both the flashlight and the revolver toward where he had heard the steps. But the hallway was deserted. Breathing through his open mouth to reduce the noise of his own rapid respiration, which he feared would mask the movements of the enemy, Ken eased along the hall into the foyer. Nothing. The front door was closed all right, but the den in the living room and the staircase in the gallery above were deserted. Click, 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 click. The noises arose from an entirely different direction now, from the back of the house and the breakfast area. The killer had fled silently out of the foyer, across the living room and dining room, into the kitchen, into the breakfast area, circling through the house, coming around behind Ken. Now the bastard was entering the hall that Ken had just left, and though the guy had been silent while flitting through the other rooms, he was making those noises again, obviously not because he had to make them, not because his shoes clicked with every step the way Ken's shoes squeaked, but because he wanted to make the noises again, wanted to taunt Ken, wanted to say, "Hey, I'm behind you now, and here I come, ready or not, here I come." Click, click, click. Ken Dimes was no coward. He was a good cop who had never walked away from trouble. He had received 2 citations for bravery and only 7 years on the force. But this faceless, insanely violent son of a bitch, scurrying through the house in total darkness, silent when he wanted to be, and making taunting sounds when it suited him, he baffled and scared Ken. And although Ken was as courageous as any cop, he was no fool. And only a fool would walk boldly into a situation that he did not understand. Instead of returning to the hall and confronting the killer, he went to the front door and reached for the lever-action brass handle, intending to get the hell out. Then he noticed the door hadn't merely been closed and deadbolted. A length of scrap wire had been wound around the handle on the fixed door and around that on the active door, linking them, fastening them together. He would have to unwind the wire before he could get out, which might take half a minute. Click, click, click. He fired once toward the hallway without even looking and ran in the opposite direction, crossing the empty living room. He heard the killer behind him, clicking, coming fast in the darkness. Yet when Ken reached the dining room and was almost to the doorway that led into the kitchen, intending to make a break for the family room and the patio door by which Teal had entered, he heard the clicking coming from in front of him. He was sure the killer had pursued him into the living room. But now the guy had gone back into the lightless hallway and was coming at him from the other direction, making a crazy game of this. From the sounds the bastard was making, he seemed just about to enter the breakfast area, which would put only the width of the kitchen between him and Ken. So Ken decided to make a stand right there, decided to blow away this psycho the moment the guy appeared in the beam of the light. Then the killer shrieked, clicking along the hallway. Still out of sight but coming toward Ken, the attacker let out a shrill, inhuman cry that was the essence of primal rage and hatred, the strangest sound that Ken had ever heard, not the sound a man would make, not even a lunatic. He gave up all thought of confrontation, pitched his flashlight into the kitchen to create a diversion, turned away from the approaching enemy, and fled again, though not back into the living room, not toward any part of the house in which this game of cat and mouse could be extended, but straight across the dining room, toward a window that glimmered vaguely with the last dim glow of twilight. He tucked his head down, brought his arms up against his chest, and turned sideways as he slammed into the glass. The window exploded, and he fell out into the rear yard, rolling through construction debris. Splintery scraps of 2x4s and chunks of concrete poked painfully into his legs and ribs. He scrambled to his feet, spun toward the house, and emptied his revolver at the broken window in case the killer was in pursuit of him. In the settling night, he saw no signs of the enemy. Figuring he had not scored a hit, he wasted no time cursing his luck. He sprinted around the house, along the side of it, out to the street. He had to get to the patrol car, where there was a radio and a pump-action riot gun. Part 3. On Wednesday and Thursday, the 2nd and 3rd of June, Travis, Nora, and Einstein searched diligently for a way to improve human-canine communications, and in the process, man and dog had almost begun to chew up furniture in frustration. However, Nora proved to have enough patience and confidence for all of them. When the breakthrough came near sunset on Friday evening, the 4th of June, she was less surprised than either Travis or Einstein. They had purchased 40 magazines, everything from Time and Life to McCall's and Red Book, and 50 books of art and photography, and had brought them to the living room of Travis's rental house, where there was space to spread everything out on the floor. They had put pillows on the floor as well, so they could work at the dog's level and be comfortable. Einstein had watched their preparations with interest. Sitting on the floor with her back against the vinyl sofa, Nora took the retriever's head in both hands, and with her face close to his, their noses almost touching, she said, "Okay, now you listen to me, Einstein. We want to know all sorts of things about you. Where you came from, why you're smarter than an ordinary dog, what you were afraid of in the woods that day Travis found you, why you sometimes stare out the window at night, as if you're frightened of something. Lots more. But you can't talk, can you?"
"No."
"And so far as we know, you can't read. And even if you can read, you can't write. So we've got to do this with pictures, I think." From where he sat near Nora, Travis could see that the dog's eyes never wavered from hers as she spoke, Einstein was rigid. His tail hung down, motionless. He not only seemed to understand what she was telling him, but he appeared to be electrified by the experiment. How much does the mutt really perceive? Travis wondered. And how many of his reactions am I imagining because of pure wishful thinking? People have a natural tendency to anthropomorphize their pets, to ascribe human perceptions and intentions to the animals where none exist. In Einstein's case, where there really was an exceptional intelligence at work, the temptation to see profound meaning in every meaningless doggy twitch was even greater than usual. We're going to study all these pictures, looking for things that interest you, for things that'll help us understand where you came from and how you got to be what you are. Every time you see something that'll help us put the puzzle together, you've got somehow to bring it to our attention. Bark at it, or put a paw on it, or wag your tail. This is nuts, Travis said. Do you understand me, Einstein? Nora asked. The retriever issued a soft woof. This will never work, Travis said. Yes, it will, Nora insisted. He can't talk, can't write, but he can show us things. If he points out a dozen pictures, we might not immediately understand what meaning they have for him, how they refer to his origins, but in time, we'll find a way to relate them to one another and to him, and we'll know what he's trying to tell us. The dog, his head still trapped firmly in Nora's hands, rolled his eyes toward Travis and woofed again. We ready? Nora asked Einstein. His gaze flicked back to her, and he wagged his tail. All right, she said, letting go of his head. Let's start. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, for hours at a time, they leafed through scores of publications, showing Einstein pictures of all kinds of things. People, trees, flowers, dogs, other animals, machines, city streets, country lanes, cars, ships, planes, food, advertisements for 1,000 products, hoping he would see something that would excite him. The problem was that he saw many things that excited him. Too many. He barked at, pawed at, woofed at, put his nose to, or wagged his tail at perhaps 100 out of the thousands of pictures. And his choices were of such variety that Travis could see no pattern to them, no way to link them and divine meaning from their association to one another. Einstein was fascinated by an automobile ad in which the car, being compared to a powerful tiger, was shown locked in an iron cage. Whether it was the car or the tiger that seized his interest was not clear. He also responded to several computer advertisements, Alpo and Purina dog chow ads, an ad for a portable stereo cassette player, and pictures of books, butterflies, a parrot, a forlorn man in a prison cell, 4 young people playing with a striped beach ball, Mickey Mouse, a violin, a man on an exercise treadmill, and many other things. He was tantalized by a photograph of a golden retriever like himself, and was downright excited by a picture of a cocker spaniel. But curiously, he showed little or no interest in other breeds of dogs. His strongest and most puzzling response was to a photo in a magazine article about an upcoming movie from 20th Century Fox. The film's story involved the supernatural, ghosts, poltergeists, demons risen from hell. And the photo that agitated him was of a slab-jawed, wickedly fanged, lantern-eyed demonic apparition. The creature was no more hideous than others in the film, less hideous than several of them, yet Einstein was affected by only that one demon. The retriever barked at the photograph. He scurried behind the sofa and peeked around the end of it, as if he thought the creature in the picture might rise off the page and come after him. He barked again, whined, and had to be coaxed back to the magazine. Upon seeing the demon a second time, Einstein growled menacingly. Frantically, he pawed at the magazine, turning its pages, until, somewhat tattered, it was completely closed. What's so special about that picture? Nora asked the dog. Einstein just stared at her and shivered slightly. Patiently, Nora reopened the magazine to the same page. Einstein closed it again. Nora opened it. Einstein closed it a third time, snatched it up in his jaws, and carried it out of the room. Travis and Nora followed the retriever into the kitchen, where they watched him go straight to the trash can. The can was one of those with a foot pedal that opened a hinged lid. Einstein put a paw on the pedal, watched the lid open, dropped the magazine into the can, and released the pedal. What's that all about? Nora wondered. I guess that's one movie he definitely doesn't want to see. Our own four-footed furry critic. That incident occurred Thursday afternoon. By early Friday evening, Travis's frustration and that of the dog were nearing critical mass. Sometimes Einstein exhibited uncanny intelligence, but sometimes he behaved like an ordinary dog. And these oscillations between canine genius and dopey mutt were enervating for anyone trying to understand how he could be so bright. Travis began to think that the best way to deal with the retriever was to just accept him for what he was. Be prepared for his amazing feats now and then, but don't expect him to deliver all the time. Most likely, the mystery of Einstein's unusual intelligence would never be solved. However, Nora remained patient. She frequently reminded them that Rome wasn't built in a day, and that any worthwhile achievement required determination, persistence, tenacity, and time. When she launched into these lectures about steadfastness and endurance, Travis sighed wearily, and Einstein yawned. Nora was unperturbed. After they'd examined the pictures in all of the books and magazines, she collected those to which Einstein had responded, spread them out across the floor, and encouraged him to make connections between one image and another. All of these are pictures of things that played important roles in his past, Nora said. I don't think we can be certain of that, Travis said. Well, that's what we've asked him to do, she said. We've asked him to indicate pictures that might tell us something about where he's come from. But does he understand the game? Yes, she said with conviction. The dog woofed. Nora lifted Einstein's paw and put it on the photograph of the violin. Okay, Pooch, you remember a violin from somewhere, and it was important to you somehow. Maybe he performed at Carnegie Hall, Travis said. Shut up. To the dog, Nora said, All right. Now, is the violin related to any of these other pictures? Is there a link to any other image that would help us understand what the violin means to you? Einstein stared at her intently for a moment, as if pondering her question. Then he crossed the room, walking carefully in the narrow aisles between the rows of photographs, sniffing, his gaze flicking left and right, until he found the ad for the Sony portable stereo cassette player. He put one paw on it and looked back at Nora. There's an obvious connection, Travis said. The violin makes music, and the cassette deck reproduces music. That's an impressive feat of mental association for a dog. But does it really mean anything else? Anything about his past? Oh, I'm sure it does, Nora said. To Einstein, she said, Did someone in your past play the violin? The dog stared at her. She said, Did your previous master have a cassette player like that one? The dog stared at her. She said, Maybe the violinist in your past used to record his own music on a cassette system? The dog blinked and whined. All right, she said. Is there another picture here that you can associate with the violin and the tape deck? Einstein stared down at the Sony ad for a moment, as if thinking, then walked into another aisle between two more rows of pictures, this time stopping at a magazine open to a Blue Cross advertisement that showed a doctor in a white coat standing at the bedside of a new mother who was holding her baby. Doctor and mother were all smiles, and the baby looked as serene and innocent as the Christ child. Crawling nearer to the dog on her hands and knees, Nora said, Does that picture remind you of the family that owned you? The dog stared at her. Was there a mother, father, a new baby in the family you used to live with? The dog stared at her. Still sitting on the floor with his back against the sofa, Travis said, Gee, maybe we've got a real case of reincarnation on our hands. Maybe old Einstein remembers being a doctor, a mother, or a baby in a previous life. Nora would not dignify that suggestion with a response. A violin-playing baby, Travis said. Einstein mewled unhappily. On her hands and knees in a dog-like position, Nora was only 2 or 3 feet from the retriever, virtually face-to-face with him. All right, this is getting us nowhere. We've got to do more than just have you associate one picture with another. We've got to be able to ask questions about these pictures and somehow get answers. Give him paper and pen, Travis said. This is serious, Nora said. impatient with Travis as she had never been with the dog. "I know it's serious," he said, "but it's also ridiculous." She hung her head for a moment, like a dog suffering in summer heat, then suddenly looked up at Einstein and said, "How smart are you really, Pooch? You want to prove you're a genius? You want to have our everlasting admiration and respect? Then here's what you have to do. Learn to answer my questions with a simple yes or no." The dog watched her closely, expectantly. "If the answer to my question is yes, wag your tail," Nora said. "But only if the answer is yes. While this test is underway, you've got to avoid wagging it out of habit or just because you get excited. Wagging is only for when you want to say yes. And when you want to say no, you bark once. Just once." Travis said, "Two barks means I'd rather be chasing cats, and three barks means get me a Budweiser."
"Don't confuse him,"
Nora said sharply.
"Why not? He confuses me."
The dog did not even glance at Travis. His large brown eyes remained focused intently on Nora as she explained the wag for yes and bark for no system again.
"All right," she said. "Let's try it. Einstein, do you understand the yes-no signs?"
The retriever wagged his tail 5 or 6 times, then stopped.
"Coincidence," Travis said, "means nothing."
Nora hesitated a moment, framing her next question, then said, "Do you know my name?" The tail wagged, stopped.
"Is my name Ellen?"
The dog barked.
"No."
"Is my name Mary?"
One bark.
"No."
"Is my name Nona?"
The dog rolled his eyes, as if chastising her for trying to trick him.
"No wagging. One bark."
"Is my name Nora?"
Einstein wagged his tail furiously.
Laughing with delight, Nora crawled forward, sat up, and hugged the retriever.
"I'll be damned," Travis said, crawling over to join them.
Nora pointed to the photo on which the retriever still had one paw.
"Did you react to this picture because it reminds you of the family you used to live with?"
One bark.
"No."
Travis said, "Did you ever live with any family?"
One bark.
"But you're not a wild dog," Nora said. "You must have lived somewhere before Travis found you." Studying the Blue Cross advertisement, Travis suddenly thought he knew all the right questions.
"Did you react to this picture because of the baby?"
One bark.
"No."
"Because of the woman?"
"No."
"Because of the man in the white lab coat?"
Much wagging.
"Yes, yes, yes."
"So he lived with a doctor," Nora said.
"Maybe a vet."
"Or maybe a scientist," Travis said, as he followed the intuitive line of thought that had stricken him.
Einstein wagged a yes at the mention of scientist.
"Research scientist," Travis said.
"Yes."
"In a lab," Travis said.
"Yes, yes, yes."
"You're a lab dog?" Nora said.
"Yes."
"A research animal,"
Travis said.
"Yes."
"And that's why you're so bright?"
"Yes."
"Because of something they've done to you?"
"Yes."
Travis's heart raced.
They actually were communicating, by God. Not just in broad strokes, and not just in the comparatively crude way he and Einstein had communicated the night that the dog had formed a question mark out of milk bones. This was communication with extreme specificity. Here they were, talking, as if they were three people. Well, almost talking. And suddenly nothing would ever be the same again. Nothing could possibly be the same in a world where men and animals possessed equal, if different, intellects. Where they faced life on equal terms, with equal rights, with similar hopes and dreams. All right, okay, so maybe he was blowing this out of proportion. Not all animals had suddenly been given human-level consciousness and intelligence. This was only one dog, an experimental animal, perhaps the only one of his kind. But Jesus. Jesus!
Travis stared in awe at the retriever, and a chill swept through him. Not a chill of fear, but of wonder. Nora spoke to the dog, and in her voice was a trace of the same awe that had briefly rendered Travis speechless.
"They didn't just let you go, did they?"
One bark.
"No."
"You escaped?"
"Yes."
"That Tuesday morning I found you in the woods," Travis asked.
Had you just escaped then?
Einstein neither barked nor wagged his tail.
Days before that? Travis asked.
The dog whined.
He probably has a sense of time, Nora said, because virtually all animals follow natural day-night rhythms, don't they? They have instinctive clocks, biological clocks. But he probably doesn't have any concept of calendar days. He doesn't really understand how we divide time up into days and weeks and months, so he has no way of answering your question.
Then that's something we'll have to teach him, Travis said.
Einstein vigorously wagged his tail. Thoughtfully, Nora said, Escaped. Travis knew what she must be thinking. To Einstein, he said,
They'll be looking for you, won't they?
The dog whined and wagged his tail, which Travis interpreted as a yes, with a special edge of anxiety. Part 4. An hour after sunset, Lemuel Johnson and Cliff Soames, trailed by two additional unmarked cars carrying 8 NSA agents, arrived at Bordeaux Ridge. The unpaved street through the center of the unfinished housing tract was lined with vehicles, mostly black and whites bearing the sheriff's department shield, plus cars and a van from the coroner's office. Lem was dismayed to see that the press had already arrived. Both print journalists and television crews with minicams were being kept behind a police line, half a block from the apparent scene of the murder. By quietly suppressing details of the death of Wesley Dahlberg and Holy Jim Canyon, and of the associated murders of the scientists working at Banodyne, and by instituting an aggressive campaign of disinformation, the NSA had managed to keep the press ignorant of the connections among all these events. Lem hoped that the deputies manning these barriers were among Walt Gaines's most trusted men, and that they would meet reporters' questions with stony silence until a convincing cover story could be developed. Sawhorses were lifted out of the way to let the unmarked NSA cars through the police line, then were put into place again. Lem parked at the end of the street, past the crime scene. He left Cliff Soames to brief the other agents, and he headed toward the unfinished house that appeared to be the focus of attention. The patrol car's radios filled the hot night air with codes and jargon, and with a hiss-pop-crackle of static, as if the whole world were being fried on a cosmic griddle. Portable Kliegs stood on tripods, flooding the front of the house with light to facilitate the investigation. Lem felt as if he were on a giant stage set. Moths swooped and fluttered around the Kliegs. Their amplified shadows darted across the dusty ground. Casting his own exaggerated shadow, he crossed the dirt yard to the house. Inside he found more Kliegs. Dazzlingly bright light bounced off white walls. Looking pale and sweaty in that harsh glare were a couple of young deputies, men from the coroner's office, and the usual intense types from the Scientific Investigation Division. A photographer's strobe flashed once, twice, from farther back in the house. The hallway looked crowded, so Lem went around to the back by way of the living room, dining room, and kitchen. Walt Gaines was standing in the breakfast area, in the dimness behind the last of the hooded Kliegs. But even in those shadows, his anger and grief were visible. He had evidently been at home when he had gotten word about the murder of a deputy, for he was wearing tattered running shoes, wrinkled tan chinos, a brown and red checkered short-sleeve shirt. In spite of his great size, bull neck, muscular arms, and big hands, Walt's clothes and slump-shouldered posture gave him the look of a forlorn little boy. From the breakfast area, Lem could not see past the lab men and into the laundry room where the body still lay. He said,
I'm sorry, Walt. I'm so sorry. Name was Teal Porter. His dad, Red Porter, and I have been friends 25 years. Red just retired from the department last year. How am I going to tell? Jesus. I've got to do it myself, us being so close. Can't pass the buck this time.
Lem knew that Walt never passed the buck when one of his men was killed in the line of duty. He always personally visited the family, broke the bad news, and sat with them through the initial shock.
Almost lost 2 men, Walt said. Other one's badly shaken. How was Teal gutted? Like Dahlberg. Decapitated.
The outsider, Lem thought. No doubt about it now. Moths had gotten inside and were bashing against the lens of the Klieg light behind which Lem and Walt stood. His voice thickening with anger, Walt said,
Haven't found his head. How do I tell his dad that Teal's head is missing?
Lem had no answer. Walt looked hard at him.
You can't push me all the way out of it now. Not now that one of my men is dead.
Walt, my agency works in purposeful obscurity. Hell, even the number of agents on the payroll is classified information. But your department is subject to full press attention. And in order to know how to proceed in this case, your people would have to be told exactly what they're looking for. That would mean revealing national defense secrets to a large group of deputies.
Your men all know what's up,
Walt countered.
Yes, but my men have signed secrecy oaths, undergone extensive security checks, and are trained to keep their mouths shut. My men can keep a secret, too.
I'm sure they can, Lem said carefully. I'm sure they don't talk outside the shop about ordinary cases, but this isn't ordinary.
No, this has to remain in our hands. Walt said, my men can sign secrecy oaths.
We'd have to background check everyone in your department. Not just deputies, but file clerks. It'd take weeks, months. Looking across the kitchen at the open door to the dining room, Walt noticed Cliff Soames and another NSA agent talking with two deputies in the next room.
You started taking over the minute you got here, didn't you? Before you even talked to me about it?
Yeah. We're making sure your people understand that they must not talk of anything they've seen here tonight, not even to their own wives. We're citing the appropriate federal laws to every man, because we want to be sure they understand the fines and prison terms.
Threatening me with jail again?
Walt asked. But there was no humor in his voice, as there had been when they'd spoken days ago in the garage of St. Joseph's Hospital after seeing Tracy Keeshan. Lem was depressed, not only by the deputy's death, but by the wedge that this case was driving between him and Walt.
I don't want anyone in jail. That's why I want to be sure they grasp the consequences.
Scowling, Walt said,
come with me.
Lem followed him outside to a patrol car in front of the house. They sat in the front seat, Walt behind the steering wheel with the doors closed.
Roll up the window so we'll have total privacy.
Lem protested that they'd suffocate in this heat without ventilation. But even in the dim light, he saw the purity and volatility of Walt's anger, and he realized his position was that of a man standing in gasoline while holding a burning candle. He rolled up his window.
Okay, Walt said. We're alone. Not NSA district director and sheriff. Just old friends. Buddies. So tell me all about it.
Walt, damn it, I can't.
Tell me now, and I'll stay off the case. I won't interfere.
Just stay off the case anyway. You have to.
Damned if I do, Walt said angrily. I can walk right down the road to those jackals.
The car faced out of Bordeaux Ridge, toward the sawhorses where reporters waited, and Walt pointed at them through the dusty windshield.
I can tell them that Banodyne Laboratories was working on some defense project that got out of hand. Tell them that someone or something strange escaped from those labs in spite of the security, and now it's loose killing people.
You do that, Lem said. You wouldn't just wind up in jail. You'd lose your job, ruin your whole career.
I don't think so.
In court, I'd claim I had to choose between breaching the national security and betraying the trust of the people who elected me to office in this county. I'd claim that in a time of crisis like this, I had to put local public safety about the concerns of the defense bureaucrats in Washington. I'm confident just about any jury would vindicate me. I'd stay out of jail, and in the next election I'd win by even more votes than I got the last time.
Shit, Lem said, because he knew Walt was correct. If you tell me about it now, if you convince me that your people are better able to handle the situation than mine, then I'll step out of your way. But if you won't tell me, I'll blow it wide open. I'd be breaking my oath. I'd be putting my neck in the noose. No one will ever know you told me.
Yeah, well then, Walt, for Christ's sake, why put me in such an awkward position just to satisfy your curiosity?
Walt looked stung. It's not as petty as that, damn you. It's not just curiosity.
Then what is it?
One of my men is dead!
Leaning his head back against the seat, Lem closed his eyes and sighed. Walt had to know why he was required to forswear vengeance for the killing of one of his own men. His sense of duty and honor would not allow him to back off without at least that much. His was not exactly an unreasonable position.
Do I go down there, talk to the reporters?
Walt asked quietly. Lem opened his eyes, wiped a hand across his damp face. The interior of the car was uncomfortably warm, muggy. He wanted to roll down his window. But now and then men walked past on their way in or out of the house, and he really could not risk anyone overhearing what he was going to tell Walt.
You were right to focus on Bannadyne. For a few years they've been doing defense-related research.
Biological warfare? Walt asked. Using recombinant DNA to make nasty new viruses?
Maybe that too, Lem said.
But germ warfare doesn't have anything to do with this case, and I'm only going to tell you about the research that's related to our problems here.
The windows were fogging. Walt started the car. There was no air conditioning, and the fog on the windows continued to spread. But even the vague, moist, warm breeze from the vents was welcome.
Lem said, they were working on several research programs under the heading of the Francis Project, named for St. Francis of Assisi.
Blinking in surprise, Walt said,
they'd name a warfare-related project after a saint.
It's apt, Lem assured him.
St. Francis could talk to birds and animals, and at Bannadyne, Dr. Davis Weatherby was in charge of a project aimed at making human-animal communication possible.
Learning the language of porpoises, that sort of thing?
No. The idea was to apply the very latest knowledge in genetic engineering to the creation of animals with a much higher order of intelligence. Animals capable of nearly human-level thought. Animals with whom we might be able to communicate.
Walt stared at him in open-mouthed disbelief.
Lem said, there have been several scientific teams working on very different experiments under the umbrella label of the Francis Project, all of which have been funded for at least 5 years. For one thing, there were Davis Weatherby's dogs.
Dr. Weatherby had been working with the sperm and ova of golden retrievers, which he had chosen because the dogs had been bred with ever greater refinement for more than 100 years. For one thing, this refinement meant that in the purest of the breed, all diseases and afflictions of an inheritable nature had been pretty much excised from the animal's genetic code, which ensured Weatherby of healthy and bright subjects for his experiments. Then, if the experimental pups were born with abnormalities of any kind, Weatherby could more easily distinguish those mutations of a natural type from those that were an unintended side effect of his own sly tampering with the animal's genetic heritage, and he would be able to learn from his own mistakes. Over the years, seeking solely to increase the intelligence of the breed without causing a change in its physical appearance, Davis Weatherby had fertilized hundreds of genetically altered retriever ova in vitro, then had transferred the fertile eggs to the wombs of bitches who served as surrogate mothers. The bitches carried the test tube pups to full term, and Weatherby studied these young dogs for indications of increased intelligence.
There were a hell of a lot of failures, Lem said. Grotesque physical mutations that had to be destroyed. Stillborn pups. Pups that looked normal but were less intelligent than usual. Weatherby was doing cross-species engineering, after all. So you can figure that some pretty horrible possibilities were realized.
Walt stared at the windshield, now entirely opaqued. Then he frowned at Lem.
Cross-species? What do you mean?
Well, you see, he was isolating those genetic determinants of intelligence in species that were brighter than the retriever.
Like apes? They'd be brighter than dogs, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Apes.
And human beings.
Jesus, Walt said. Lem adjusted a dashboard vent to direct the flow of tepid air into his face. Weatherby was inserting that foreign genetic material into the retriever's genetic code, simultaneously editing out the dog's own genes that limited its intelligence to that of a dog.
Walt rebelled. That's not possible. This genetic material, as you call it, surely it can't be passed from one species to another.
It happens in nature all the time, Lem said. Genetic material is transferred from one species to another, and the carrier is usually a virus. Let's say a virus thrives in rhesus monkeys. While in the monkey, it acquires genetic material from the monkey cells. These acquired monkey genes become a part of the virus itself. Later, upon infecting a human host, that virus has the capability of leaving the monkey's genetic material in its human host. Consider the AIDS virus, for instance. It's believed AIDS was a disease carried by certain monkeys and by human beings for decades, though neither species was susceptible to it. I mean, we were strictly carriers. We never got sick from what we carried. But then, somehow,
Something happened in monkeys. A negative genetic change that made them not only carriers but victims of the AIDS virus. Monkeys began to die of the disease. Then when the virus passed to humans, it brought with it this new genetic material specifying susceptibility to AIDS. So before long, human beings were also capable of contracting the disease. That's how it works in nature. It's done even more efficiently in the lab. As creeping condensation fogged the side windows, Walt said, "So Weatherby really succeeded in breeding a dog with human intelligence?" It was a long, slow process, but gradually he made advancements. And a little over a year ago, the miracle pup was born. "Thinks like a human being? Not like a human being, but maybe as well as. Yet it looks like an ordinary dog." That was what the Pentagon wanted, which made Weatherby's job a lot harder, I guess. Apparently brain size has at least a little bit to do with intelligence, and Weatherby might have made his breakthrough a lot sooner if he'd been able to develop a retriever with a larger brain. But a larger brain would have meant a reconfigured and much larger skull, so the dog would have looked damn unusual. All the windows were fogged over now. Neither Walt nor Lem tried to clear the misted glass. Unable to see out of the car, confined to its humid and claustrophobic interior, they seemed to be cut off from the real world, adrift in time and space, a condition that was oddly conducive to the consideration of the wondrous and outrageous acts of creation that genetic engineering made possible. Walt said, "The Pentagon wanted a dog that looked like a dog but could think like a man? Why?" "Imagine the possibilities for espionage," Lem said. "In times of war, dogs would have no trouble getting deep into enemy territory, scouting installations, and troop strength. Intelligent dogs with whom we could somehow communicate would then return and tell us what they had seen and what they'd overheard the enemy talking about." "Tell us? Are you saying dogs could be made to talk? Like canine versions of Francis the Mule or Mr. Ed? Shit, Lem, be serious." Lem sympathized with his friend's difficulty in absorbing these astounding possibilities. Modern science was advancing so rapidly, with so many revolutionary discoveries to be explored every year, that to laymen there was going to be increasingly less difference between the application of that science and magic. Few non-scientists had any appreciation for how different the world of the next 20 years was going to be from the world of the present, as different as the 1980s were from the 1780s. Change was occurring at an incomprehensible rate, and when you got a glimpse of what might be coming, as Walt just had, it was both inspiring and daunting, exhilarating and scary. Lem said, "In fact, a dog probably can be genetically altered to be able to speak. Might even be easy, I don't know. But to give it the necessary vocal apparatus, the right kind of tongue and lips, that'd mean drastically altering its appearance, which is no good for the Pentagon's purposes. So these dogs wouldn't speak. Communication would no doubt have to be through an elaborate sign language." "You're not laughing," Walt said. "This has got to be a fucking joke. So why aren't you laughing?" "Think about it," Lem said patiently. "In peacetime, imagine the President of the United States presenting the Soviet premier with a 1-year-old golden retriever as a gift from the American people. Imagine the dog living in the premier's home and office, privy to the most secret talks of the USSR's highest party officials. Once in a while, every few weeks or months, the dog might manage to slip out at night, to meet with a U.S. agent in Moscow and be debriefed." "Debriefed? This is insane," Walt said, and he laughed. But his laughter had a sharp, hollow, decidedly nervous quality, which to Lem indicated that the sheriff's skepticism was slipping away, even though he wanted to hold on to it. "I'm telling you that it's possible, that such a dog was in fact conceived by in vitro fertilization of a genetically altered ovum by genetically altered sperm, and carried to term by a surrogate mother. And after a year of confinement at the Banodyne Labs, sometime in the early morning hours of Monday, May 17th, that dog escaped by a series of incredibly clever actions that cannily circumvented the facility's security system."
"And now the dog's loose?"
"Yes.
And that's what's been killing—"
"No," Lem said. "The dog is harmless,
affectionate, a wonderful animal. I was in Weatherby's lab while he was working with the retriever. In a limited way, I communicated with it. Honest to God, Walt, when you see that animal in action, see what Weatherby created, it gives you enormous hope for this sorry species of ours. Walt stared at him, uncomprehending. Lem searched for the words to convey what he felt. As he found the language to describe what the dog had meant to him, his chest grew tight with emotion. Well, I mean, if we can do these amazing things, if we can bring such a wonder into the world, then there's something of profound value in us, no matter what the pessimists and doomsayers believe. If we can do this, we have the power and potentially the wisdom of God. We're not only makers of weapons, but makers of life. If we could lift members of another species up to our level, create a companion race to share the world, our beliefs and philosophies would be changed forever. By the very act of altering the retriever, we've altered ourselves. By pulling the dog to a new level of awareness, we are inevitably raising our own awareness as well. Jesus, Lem, you sound like a preacher. Do I? That's because I've had more time to think about this than you have. In time, you'll understand what I'm talking about. You'll begin to feel it too, this incredible sense that humankind is on its way to godhood, and that we deserve to get there. Walt Gaines stared at the steamed glass, as if reading something of great interest in the patterns of condensation. Then, maybe what you say is right. Maybe we're on the brink of a new world. But for now, we've got to live in and deal with the old one. So if it wasn't the dog that killed my deputy, what was it? Something else escaped from Bannadyne the same night that the dog got out, Lem said. His euphoria was suddenly tempered by the need to admit that there had been a darker side to the Francis Project. They called it the Outsider. Part 5. Nora held up the magazine ad that compared an automobile to a tiger and that showed the car in an iron cage. To Einstein, she said, "All right, let's see what else you can clarify for us. How about this one? What is it that interests you in this photograph? The car?" Einstein barked once. "No." "Was it the tiger?" Travis asked. One bark. "The cage?" Nora asked. Einstein wagged his tail. "Yes." "Did you choose this picture because they kept you in a cage?" Nora asked. "Yes." Travis crawled across the floor until he found the photo of a forlorn man in a prison cell. Returning with it, showing it to the retriever, he said, "And did you choose this one because the cell is like a cage?" "Yes." "And because the prisoner in the picture reminded you of how you felt when you were in the cage?" "Yes." "The violin," Nora said. "Did someone at the laboratory play the violin for you?" "Yes." "Why would they do that, I wonder?" Travis said. That was one the dog could not answer with a simple yes or no. "Did you like the violin?" Nora asked. "Yes." "You like music in general?" "Yes." "Do you like jazz?" The dog neither barked nor wagged his tail. Travis said, "He doesn't know what jazz is. I guess they never let him hear any of that." "Do you like rock and roll?" Nora asked. One bark and simultaneously a wagging of the tail. "What's that supposed to mean?" Nora asked. "Probably means yes and no," Travis said. "He likes some rock and roll, but not all of it." Einstein wagged his tail to confirm Travis's interpretation. "Classical?" Nora asked. "Yes." Travis said, "So we've got a dog that's a snob, huh?" "Yes, yes, yes." Nora laughed in delight, and so did Travis. And Einstein nuzzled and licked them happily. Travis looked around for another picture, snatched up the one of the man on the exercise treadmill. "They wouldn't want to let you out of the lab, I guess. Yet they'd want to keep you fit. Is this how they exercised you? On a treadmill?" "Yes." The sense of discovery was exhilarating. Travis would have been no more thrilled, no more excited, no more awe-stricken if he had been communicating with an extraterrestrial intelligence. Part 6. "I'm falling down a rabbit hole," Walt Gaines thought uneasily as he listened to Lem Johnson.
This new high-tech world of spaceflight, computers in the home, satellite-relayed telephone calls, factory robots, and now biological engineering seemed utterly unrelated to the world in which he was born and grew up. For God's sake, he had been a child during World War II, when there had not even been jet aircraft. He hailed from a simpler world of boat-like Chryslers with tail fins, phones with dials instead of push buttons, clocks with hands instead of digital display boards. Television did not exist when he was born, and the possibility of nuclear Armageddon within his own lifetime was something no one then could have predicted. He felt as though he had stepped through an invisible barrier from his world into another reality that was on a faster track. This new kingdom of high technology could be delightful or frightening, and occasionally both at the same time. Like now. The idea of an intelligent dog appealed to the child in him and made him want to smile. But something else, the outsider, had escaped from those labs, and it scared the bejesus out of him. "The dog had no name," Lem Johnson said. "That's not so unusual. Most scientists who work with lab animals never name them. If you've named an animal, they'll inevitably begin to attribute a personality to it, and then your relationship to it will change, and you'll no longer be as objective in your observations as you have to be. So the dog had only a number until it was clear this was the success Weatherby had been working so hard to achieve. Even then, when it was evident that the dog would not have to be destroyed as a failure, no name was given to it. Everyone simply called it the dog, which was enough to differentiate it from all of Weatherby's other pups, because they'd been referred to by numbers. Anyway, at the same time, Dr. Yarbeck was working on other, very different research under the Francis Project umbrella, and she, too, finally met with some success. Yarbeck's objective was to create an animal with dramatically increased intelligence. But one also designed to accompany men into war as police dogs accompanied cops in dangerous urban neighborhoods. Yarbeck sought to engineer a beast that was smart, but also deadly. A terror on the battlefield. Ferocious, stealthy, cunning, and intelligent enough to be effective in both jungle and urban warfare. Not quite as intelligent as human beings, of course. Not as smart as the dog that Weatherby was developing. It would be sheer madness to create a killing machine as intelligent as the people would have to use and control it. Everyone had read Frankenstein, or had seen one of the old Karloff movies, and no one underestimated the dangers inherent in Yarbeck's research. Choosing to work with monkeys and apes because of their naturally high intelligence, and because they already possessed human-like hands, Yarbeck ultimately selected baboons as the base species for her dark acts of creation. Baboons were among the smartest of primates, good raw material. They were deadly and effective fighters by nature, with impressive claws and fangs, fiercely motivated by the territorial imperative, and eager to attack those whom they perceived as enemies. Yarbeck's first task in the physical alteration of the baboon was to make it larger, big enough to threaten a grown man, Lem said. She decided that it would have to stand at least 5 feet and weigh 100 to 110 pounds. "That's not so big," Walt protested. "Big enough. I could swat down a man that size. A man, yes, but not this thing. It's solid muscle, no fat at all, and far quicker than a man. Stop and think of how a 50-pound pit bull can make mincemeat of a grown man, and you'll realize what a threat Yarbeck's warrior could be at 110. The patrol car's steam-silvered windshield seemed like a movie screen, on which Walt saw projected images of brutally murdered men. Wes Dahlberg, Teal Porter. He closed his eyes, but still saw cadavers. "Okay, yeah, I get your point. 110 pounds would be enough if we're talking about something designed to fight and kill." Yarbeck created a breed of baboons that would grow to greater size. Then she set to work altering the sperm and ova for giant primates in other ways, sometimes by editing the baboon's own genetic material, sometimes by introducing genes from other species. Walt said, "The same sort of cross-species patch and stitch that led to the smart dog. I wouldn't call it patch and stitch, but yeah. Essentially the same techniques." Yarbeck wanted a large, vicious jaw on her warrior, something more like that of a German shepherd, even a jackal, so there'd be room for more teeth. And she wanted the teeth to be larger and sharper, and perhaps slightly hooked,
which meant she had to enlarge the baboon's head and totally alter its facial structure to accommodate all of this. The skull had to be greatly enlarged anyway,